I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today, we're going outdoors and exploring the greenways and bike lanes of cities. Greg Moore is the executive director of the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy. He'll tell us how the former military outpost became one of the largest greenways in the U.S. and how he brought together cross-sector leaders to turn the tide toward environmental action. And in a time of climate change and car worship, riding a bike has become a political statement and a policy issue. We'll speak with author, journalist, and avid cyclist Jeff Mapes about his book, Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing the World. All this plus the latest from Plan Edison's Nate Berg and our City Views commentator Walker Smith, coming up after the news on Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Recently, the Institute at Golden Gate held an event called Turning the Tide for the Environment. The event brought together environmentalists, Nobel laureates, CEOs, philanthropists, and more to find creative solutions to today's most pressing environmental problems. My first guest on today's show is one of the people who made Turning the Tide happen. Greg Moore is the executive director of the Golden Gate Parks Conservancy, a nonprofit partner that supports and assists the Golden Gate National Parks in research, interpretation, and conservation programs. I asked Greg to describe the Golden Gate Parks.
The Golden Gate National Parks are one of the most amazing and unique national parks in any city in the world. It's a 80,000-acre greenbelt. It includes 10 former military posts being converted to national parks. We have about 20 million visitors each year and stretch up and down three counties of the San Francisco Bay Area, 80 miles of coastline, including places very well known like Alcatraz Island or Muir Woods, and many places that are not as well known, but an important part of this incredible greenbelt in the Bay Area.
I'm curious how the former military post, you said 10 of them, were made into national parks. Is that not unusual if you look across the country?
It's not common, but it has happened in other areas as well. And in our case, it comes from the basic history of the Bay Area with this incredible harbor where the military put installations to protect that harbor entrance starting back at the gold rush of California. But over time, that military defense function became obsolete. And through a national legislation called the Base Realignment and Closure Act, bit by bit, these obsolete military posts were closed down. And in the legislation for the Golden Gate National Parks passed in 1972, Congress and the Bay Area community had the foresight to imagine that someday these historic places at the core of the Bay Area, at the Golden Gate entrance, would outlive their military purpose, and wrote into the legislation that if that ever happened, they would transfer to this new national park, thinking perhaps that that might be 100 years from 1972. Well, sometimes history creeps up on you, and by 1988, the military posts were beginning to close as part of this realignment act.
Wow. Golden Gate Parks are national parks, which means they're owned by the federal government and in turn by all of us, yet their benefit accrues most directly to San Francisco. Have you ever calculated the benefit to the city of having these parks on the city's doorstep?
We have, of course, on a day-to-day basis. It's just easy to watch people that are in the park virtually every hour of the day, whether it's their morning run or their afternoon walk or a picnic or a school group. So the day-to-day visitation and enjoyment by Bay Area residents is probably between 10 to 15 million a year. Then on top of that, of course, we have destinations that draw people from around the country and around the world. So the travel and tourism benefits to the Bay Area, the economic benefits are there as well. And, anytime you just look out an office window or a nearby residence and see the beauty of that harbor entrance and its open space protected, you can see that there were some wise people making a decision to save this place, not only for the Bay Area, but for all Americans.
I presume there was some sort of big battle about using this land for more commercial purposes when it was given up by the military. Were you part of that discussion?
Yes, like many places that people care about, and national parks certainly are up in the list, the public tends to have strong points of view about how they're cared for and what their future should be. And in our case, we had something fairly unprecedented, the requirement, the opportunity, and the challenge to reinvent these military places into their new public purposes, national parks. So in each case, creating the right vision, getting the community consensus, and having a tremendous amount of perseverance are the qualities that, in the end, create the public benefit, the accomplishment of reinventing these sites.
Tell me about the role of the conservancy that you run. What role does the conservancy play in the parks?
The conservancy plays a number of roles. First of all, we offer our help in bringing in talent and community input to create the right vision for these national park sites. In the early days of the Presidio closure, for example, a very important military post now within a national park, we assembled a national group of distinguished Americans to help advise what the future of the Presidio should be and how it could make its way. So part of what we do is simply bring in the talent and a public dialogue that gets to a hopefully a very positive conclusion. We also bring in philanthropic funds to help improve the sites, to make them offer more benefits for the community, whether it's school programs or restoration efforts. And we mobilize volunteers on behalf of the park. This park has 20,000 volunteers, a small city of people helping care for it and making it available to the public.
How do you work with the federal government? I mean, I'm just curious. This notion of the conservancy, a private nonprofit organization bringing talent that helps create vision for a federal asset. How does that work in reality? What is the relationship like, and what does each side have to do to make it productive?
It's definitely a give and take. We have to understand as a nonprofit that we are not the ultimate decision makers. The federal government manages and cares for these sites, and they are in charge of the final decisions about how they're used and how we're cared for. On the other hand, we believe, and so does the National Park Service management here, that there's an incredible value to community engagement, to bringing in fresh ideas, to engaging people from outside the federal sector to think creatively about the opportunities ahead of us, and ultimately to build a community of people dedicated to these places over time. So we, over the years that we've been around, which is a little over 25 right now, we found our way working with the federal government, both the National Park Service and the Presidio Trust, to add value to their work and to understand how we can be effective in doing that.
Is the relationship between the Conservancy and Golden Gate National Parks an unusual one for a national park, or is this typical? Do most national parks have private organizations supporting them in some way?
Most do. In fact, the very first organization established to help a national park was in Yosemite National Park in 1923, when a group of citizens wanted to help raise funds for the Yosemite Museum. So across the country, most national parks have nonprofit partner organizations, friends of national parks, helping them make their way and ultimately adding their value to these incredible American places.
Is the Golden Gate Parks Conservancy made up only of local people, or does it have representation from other parts of the country?
We have a membership base, and most of that is in the Bay Area, but there are people around the country that are part of our membership base as well. And at times, depending on the opportunity we're facing, we will bring in people from around the country to help us think things through and add a more national perspective to our work here in the Bay Area.
You recently staged a gathering you called Turning the Tide on the topic of sustainability. I was there. Tell me what you expected to happen at that meeting and what you hoped would result.
Sure. And Turning the Tide, just to return to our earlier discussion, occurred at Fort Baker. Once again, a reinvented military post, once used for military defense and now dedicated to environmental defense. And Turning the Tide was a gathering of environmental thinkers, innovators, and mainly people committed to environmental action from around the country, organized under different topics of environmental concern to begin to create action plans for helping move our world in a better direction environmentally. We sponsored a number of guilds that were cross-sector in composition to look at issues such as conserving the commons, the public assets of our environment, leadership cities, which I believe you were a part of, Carol. And these groups of people not only inspired one another with their work, but began to dedicate themselves to follow-up actions that they would do and to inspiring action around these various topics.
Do you feel that they are shaping an agenda for the Conservancy that you will take forward, or are you simply the convener?
I would say we are definitely the convener, gathering the right people together and giving them the opportunity to share their visions and their practices, and also hopefully the catalyst by bringing people together who might not have had the time or connection to other people that have common purpose, that will create networks and catalyze, inspire environmental action that happens beyond the Conservancy's stewardship of the individual program that occurred.
I want to come back to your comments about Fort Baker now being dedicated to environmental defense, where once it was military defense. Who made that decision? Was that a federal decision? Was that a Conservancy decision? Was it a joint decision? How did that theme and that purpose come to be attached to Fort Baker?
In general, with these military posts that transfer to national parks, public planning process is set up to begin to develop the long-range plan and provide the environmental analysis and public review of that plan. So that was a very extensive process that took place, almost over a 5 to 8 year period. And the conclusion of that process was that the historic military buildings at Fort Baker would have two purposes. One, to serve as a National Park Lodge within the midst of the Golden Gate National Parks. These were officers' homes and barracks that converted beautifully to overnight lodging and meeting space. And secondly, to infuse that new use with a programmatic purpose that related to the very mission of our national parks, to conserve the world around us and to pass it on to future generations, hopefully in better shape. So that programmatic piece was added to the lodge, taking advantage of the overnight rooms and the meeting spaces to convene people around critical environmental topics of our time. The facilities were all renovated according to LEED design principles, so we have the largest green meeting facility in the Bay Area. It's in the middle of a national park and marine sanctuary, so everywhere you look, you see the environmental goals that we're pursuing in action in terms of the preserve lands around us. And of course, we're in the Bay Area, which has so much talent in the area of environmental innovation and thinking, and talent that we will draw upon at the Institute of the Golden Gate.
It really is a stunning site and stunning facility. It is quite beautiful, but I want to come back to something you said. You said the planning took place over a 5 to 8 year period. I mean, people died, people were born during that period. What took so long?
Well,
is that a healthy thing?
I mentioned the word perseverance, and I think with any major change within an urban community, you're in there for the long haul. And there was a lot of debate about the future of Fort Baker and what it should become. The debate was primarily about the scale of the facility that would ultimately end up there and whether it would have negative impacts on nearby neighborhoods and communities. So that took a long time to work out, the question of just what is the appropriate size of the facility. And we needed to have a size that would be, over time, financially viable, that place could attract the visitors it needed, provide the income to preserve it over time. So there were many issues that had to be worked out with the local public review process.
Well, local public review can be exhausting. It's hard to create and keep momentum up over that long period of time. I want to go back to Turning the Tide. Did it meet your expectations? Did that, 3-day event, conversation with people who are committed, as you say, to sustainability from many different organizations, many different ages, mostly from the Bay Area, but certainly you had people from other parts of the country as well. Did that conversation lead to something you think is going to be important? Did it meet your expectations?
Absolutely, it didn't. It was our first major environmental program at the Institute, so we were new out of the gate. We were not only testing this new facility and its ability to host convenings like this, but meeting new people for the first time and hoping we created the right combination of leaders and innovators and chemistry to excite people and keep the dialogue going. The reviews that we've gotten back for Turning the Tide have been phenomenally positive. So that's the main test in many ways of whether we accomplished our hopes and dreams for that event. And we're now working on the follow-up work with many of the participants to keep that dialogue going, to inspire those environmental leaders, and to, as I said before, hopefully catalyze and support the action that they're taking to improve our world and address the environmental challenges we face.
What role do you see the convener catalyst role as your continuing role at the Institute, or do you see using the parks as a way to act on some of the sustainability agenda?
I think both, Carol. Certainly the convening and catalyst role will be central and long term. But we have the additional benefit of the park itself being its own classroom of environmental action in terms of the, whether it's the reinvention of these military posts, the community stewardship programs that we host, the restoration work that we undertake, and the connections between these parks and the cities around it. 50% of our world now lives in cities, and within 10 years it'll be up to 60%. So in many ways, getting our cities right is a fundamental environmental question in terms of the future of not only the livabilities of our cities, but the sustainability of our planet.
Well, you know you'll get no argument from me on that. Let me ask you, the sustainability field now is, shall we say, crowded with everyone who sees an opportunity either to do good or to make a buck and, you know, take advantage of the new interest at the federal level and municipal level. And so there are a lot of people crowding into this field with conferences and conversations and, thank goodness, technologies, et cetera, workforce training for green jobs, whatever those are. How do you see yourself fitting into this increasingly crowded field? Where is your unique opportunity to catalyze a conversation that you think is not being held elsewhere?
Sure, and I'll start by saying that I get optimistic when a field of importance gets crowded because it shows that a critical issue that we're facing is attracting the public visibility and attention that it needs. And of course, within that crowd, everyone hopes that they're playing an important role that leverages and works with the role of others that are part of that community. At Fort Baker, our niche comes from, first of all, the place itself and its ability to host people working in the environmental arena and hopefully host them in a way that inspires their continued work and creates the networks to make their work better. Secondly, the draw we have within the Bay Area community for people that are in a public, private, and nonprofit sector working on environmental issues. And third, this national park connection that we have, which hopefully creates additional inspiration for this work. There are many environmental institutes, more and more all the time, actually, as you suggested, in the country, some with longstanding reputations like the Rocky Mountain Institute and others newer to the table. And we will do our work to make certain that we, as we evolve, play our part effectively within that community and develop our distinct niche.
What is the Conservancy's ambition both for itself and for Golden Gate National Parks?
You know, our ambition really, I don't know that we have an ambition for ourselves. We certainly have an ambition for the Golden Gate National Parks. And the ambition for the Golden Gate National Parks is summed up perhaps in our basic motto, which is parks for all forever. Our first job, of course, is to pay attention to these parks, these treasured and timeless places within our urban community, and to do what we can to increase their preservation and community value. The for all piece represents our belief that these are public assets. They're owned by all of us, and therefore we have an opportunity and an obligation even to make them accessible to the broad spectrum of our community. Not only the people that have the wonderful benefit of living on the doorstep of these beautiful places, but people in urban neighborhoods who may have trouble getting out of their neighborhoods and enjoying the national parks on their doorstep. And finally, the forever is our hope that we are creating the community affection and action to steward these places into the future in the best possible shape for future generations of people who we know will love and benefit from these places in the same way that we do today.
Greg, your work is important for all Americans. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Carol, my pleasure.
Greg Moore is the executive director of the Golden Gate Parks Conservancy. He joined us from the studios at KQED in San Francisco. For more information about the Golden Gate Parks and to see videos from Turning the Tide, go to our website, smartcityradio.com. And now for the latest news in urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plant Edison.
Given the current economic climate, it's kind of hard to think that there could be good places to find jobs, but according to the experts, they're out there. Kiplinger's Personal Finance magazine recently came out with its list of the top 10 cities for stable employment and new career opportunities. Most, if not all, of the cities on the list are surprises, but that probably makes sense during these strange times. Topping the list is Huntsville, Alabama, which has been able to maintain economic prosperity thanks to its thriving aerospace and medical sectors. Also making the top 10 are Athens, Georgia, Madison, Wisconsin, and Raleigh, North Carolina. The creative class of highly educated and knowledge-based workers is cited as one of the major factors determining this year's list. Meanwhile, times are looking tough for California's state parks. The Associated Press reported recently that budget woes could bring the closure of up to 220 parks across the state, at least temporarily. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has suggested cutting $70 million in park spending for the next fiscal year, and almost $150 million more for the next fiscal year. These cuts are seen as a quick way to save some cash, but parks officials and conservationists say the effect would be too extreme. The proposed cuts would leave just 59 of California's 279 state parks open. Last year, the state legislature shot down a Schwarzenegger plan to close 48 state parks. But the current economic situation has many in the state confident that this year's bigger and broader cuts are more likely to pass. And finally, Stephen Chu, the new U.S. Energy Secretary, is thinking white. He's the latest and possibly most prominent official to get behind the idea of using white-colored roofing and paving materials to reduce the amount of heat urban areas absorb. According to a recent article from The Times, Chu says building codes should be updated to allow roads and roofs to take on lighter tones that reflect rather than absorb the heat of the sun. Dark surfaces like traditional asphalt and dark roofs absorb about 80% of the sunlight that falls on them, while lighter surfaces have been reported to absorb only about 20%. Lightening the tones of paved surfaces could play a major role in reducing carbon emissions that result from the energy used to heat and cool buildings. A nationwide plan may not be right around the corner, but with an advocate in the White House, building roofs may begin to see a brighter future. For Plant Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlantEdison.com. There's more Smart City after the break. Author and journalist Jeff Mapes joins us to talk about building a bike-friendly city. I'm Carol Coletta.
Hi, I'm Scotty Iseri, and if you're hearing my voice right now, it means you're listening to the podcast version of Smart City. And I have a message specifically for you, the podcast listener. We usually get a lot of really great comments via email from our listeners. They have questions about the show, things they heard. They have comments about things we got wrong or things we got right. Really intelligent input, and we thought, why don't we create a space online where our listeners can talk to each other? That's why we've created My City. My City is a social networking site for urban enthusiasts, people that love cities, people that want to see cities thrive, people that have ideas about making the next great city. So, how do you join? You send me an email. My personal email, I'm giving this out. Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com. Send me an email, I'll send you an invite, join the conversation online. One more time, it's Scotty at smartcityradio.com. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Smart City, I'm Carol Coletta. Jeff Mapes covers politics for The Oregonian, Portland's daily newspaper. He's also an avid bicyclist and has written a book about cycling culture that covers everything from the political significance of the bicycle to the world capitals of bicycle culture. Portland is one of those cities, and he joins us to talk about the new urban bike movement and how Portland became the bike capital of the United States. Jeff, it seems like cycling has gone from fringe movement to being considered as a serious mode of transportation almost overnight. How did we get here?
You know, that is really fascinating. I started working on my book, Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities. That subtitle, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities, when I first started thinking about it, I thought was maybe a little brash, you know, back in 2005 when I started working on it. By the time I was ready to put this book to print late last year, I had no doubts that that title was perfectly suitable. I had to keep rewriting chunks of it because the situation kept changing. Well, it seemed like it happened overnight. This has been growing for many years, and a lot of factors have really come together. We'll start in the 90s when we all of a sudden started having a lot of concerns about the lack of exercise that Americans were getting, you know, the growing obesity crisis. People were really looking for ways to integrate physical activity into their life. That was one thing. You know, the 90s was a time when commute distances just grew astronomically. You know, the miles that people drove in their cars expanded much more quickly than the population. And, you know, that kind of created a counter-reaction. A lot of people decided, you know, that's not the lifestyle that I want. Then we get into the 2000s. We start seeing discussion of climate change. We start hearing discussion of peak oil, and then gas prices start rising. And throughout all this, you know, starting in 1991, we started getting significant federal funding for bicycle and pedestrian projects. There's been just kind of an explosion of trail building around the country, you know, the whole rails to trails projects. And a lot of cities were starting to build bicycle infrastructure. You know, bike lanes really started appearing en masse starting in the 90s. And that also encouraged people to ride. So it was a lot of things coming together.
To what extent has mass travel to Europe, particularly, I think of Amsterdam, you've written about Amsterdam, which is a very common destination for U.S. citizens going to Europe. How much do you think that travel has influenced the bicycle's place in our transport system?
Oh, well, there is no doubt that there are so many people who go to Europe and say, my gosh, this really works. This is a wonderful experience. And they brought that back. Portland, where I live, really consciously designed a lot of its bicycle network on things that planners, transportation people, bicycle advocates saw on trips to Europe and particularly to the Netherlands.
What are some of those things? What defines a bike-friendly city?
Okay, well, I'll give you several things. One thing that I think is very important is that you kind of have a complete route for bicycles, not just enough to stripe a bike lane here or there or say, gee, here's a nice recreational trail, but you really need to think out where do people need to go in this city, you know, just in the same way you would think it out if you're planning a network for vehicle travel or for light rail or buses. It's as important for bicycles as for everybody else. So I'd say that's one important thing. I think another thing that's important is if you design a city for being in the city instead of just rushing people in and out of the city as so many American cities did, you know, really kind of in the big freeway building era, then I think that starts to create a bicycle-friendly city. Because one thing that, you know, I think is very important to keep in mind about this is bicycles work best on short trips. And if everybody has to travel long distances to get to where they're going, by definition, that becomes much more difficult.
You include a chapter in your book on creating the new urban bike culture. In particular, you write about critical mass. Describe critical mass for those who don't haven't experienced that in their city.
Right. You know, that's one of those, frankly, kind of unique bicycle things. Maybe it says something about the mindset of so many cyclists are such individualists. It's actually technically a leaderless ride. There's no organization, you know, no critical mass organization. What it is a group of cyclists who meet together, typically in most cities where it happens. It's on the last Friday of the month, you know, right around the end of rush hour, you know, in downtown areas. You know, it usually starts around 6 o'clock or so. So it does annoy a lot of motorists. And the idea is basically to get, quote unquote, a critical mass of cyclists, enough of them, so that they feel kind of comfortable taking over at least a whole lane of travel. In many cities, they literally block off intersections when the group comes through. It's almost like a moving parade. It's very controversial in bike advocacy circles. I mean, I would say if you want to get fistfight started, at a convention of bicycle advocates, you know, from mainstream bike groups, bring up the issue of critical mass. And there's, you know, a lot of feeling about whether it helps or hurts the movement. My conclusion is I think it really depends on the city. You know, San Francisco has a very different culture than, say, Louisville, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. You live and work in Portland, as you said earlier. That's a very bicycle-friendly city. Describe that journey in Portland and that other cities can learn from. How did Portland become such a bike-friendly city, and specifically what makes it bike-friendly?
Right. You know, one thing that I think is important to talk about is that when visitors come to Portland now, one thing locals like to do is show them the Hawthorne Bridge during rush hour. There's several bridges over the Willamette River. You know, we have our downtown on the west side of the Willamette River. Most of the people in the city live on the east side of the Willamette River, so you get a lot of bicycle travel over the river bridges, and the one that gets the most bike travel is the Hawthorne Bridge, where you get about 5,000 cyclists a day, so about 10,000 trips over that bridge. And at rush hour, it is just a steady stream of cyclists. In fact, they're having congestion problems on this bridge walkway that everybody rides on. And it really is quite an amazing sight, something that, you know, you won't see in many places in the U.S., something more common to Amsterdam. But I think a very important thing to talk about this is that it didn't always used to be this way. I mean, when the city does all sorts of bicycle counts over the bridges, and we're now getting more people going over the bridges on bikes in the dead of winter, you know, in January, than you used to get at the height of summer 15 years ago, I think, roughly. And so we have really seen an explosion that has really happened in a relatively short amount of time. So for those who say, well, Portland's always been like this, it's always been part of the culture, that's not really the case. Now, that's not to say there wasn't a lot of people who liked to ride in Portland. The east side of the city, an important thing is the city starts out with what a real estate person would call good bones, in that it has a good grid street system, particularly on the east side, relatively flat, left over from the streetcar era. You know, the way they built streets during the streetcar era with grid system streets, block streets, is very, very good for bicycling because it provides a lot of routes for bicycles to go. You're not just to get somewhere, you're not forced on to, you know, arterials with fast-moving automobile traffic. So that's one thing that the city started out as an advantage. Another important thing is that they made room for bikes on the road. They had a supportive city government that put in a major bicycle network, which really helped move bicycling beyond just the province of sort of hardcore riders who are willing to tolerate a fair amount of traffic, and kind of helped provide an invitation for more people to take it up. There was also a real focus on safety. The city did a lot to do traffic calming around the city. You know, there's been various traffic calming projects in neighborhood. The city now, I think about a year or so ago, installed its 1,000th speed hump, not, you know, one of those little narrow speed bumps, but almost speed hump where if you go about 25, it really, you don't feel a real jarring in your car or anything like that. But it does help slow down traffic. They've tried to pay attention and do things where there were conflict areas to provide extra safety to separate out bikes and cars. They still have a long way to go on that. And then, you know, a whole other factor that has been important to Portland's rise as really the bicycle capital of the United States, has been kind of a culture has developed. And it's been nurtured by a lot of people. Critical mass has really been a relatively small part of it. I mean, a big part of it is a lot of young, creative people moving to Portland. They love the fact that this is a town where they can live relatively cheaply, you know, rent a house with a bunch of friends. They don't need a car to get around. They can get around using light rail, bus, and bicycle is a big part of it. You know, there's a lot of freedom to a bike, ability to move around, go, you know, at your own pace when you want to. They started doing all sorts of quirky, interesting, artistic things, having bicycle fairs, mutant bike builders came up. You know, one day I was riding to work a couple weeks ago, and I'm riding down a bike lane, and all of a sudden, over my left shoulder, I hear this, almost feels like this voice of God saying, "On your left." And it's like, wait a minute, this is too high to be another cyclist. But all of a sudden, this guy comes by me on a tall bike, what's called a tall bike, and it's two bicycle frames welded together. It looked like a circus rider. So he's up, you know, 8 or 9 feet above me, and he just blew right by me. And I thought, wow, now that's impressive. You know, and then that really starts to change the whole image of cycling. You know, look how much – I mean, as an example, I don't know if you remember the movie, the 40-Year-Old Virgin. Now think of this, the hapless hero of this movie at the beginning, you know, a guy who'd never been kissed literally – he rode a bicycle, you know, so it was basically, you know, this is a sign of impotency. You know, to be powerful, you have to be driving a nice, flashy new car. And this new bike culture, they're turning it into an image of strength, really. And that is important, you know, because if it's not appealing in a lot of different senses to people, they're not going to do it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeff Mapes, author of the book Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing the World. I'm fascinated by culture change in cities. And they're not easy to pull off, and they're really not easy to pull off when you're trying to be intentional. I'm curious, did this culture change, do you feel it just bubbled up, or was there anything, in fact, intentional about it?
You know, you're right. It never is, you know, as we learned from the urban renewal of the 50s and 60s, it's not enough to just bulldoze several neighborhoods over and do this entire planned blocks and everything, you know, and you end up with a lot of sterility is what happens. Now, you can guide it, though. And I mean, in many ways, this bike culture I'm talking about sort of developed on its own, but it did get encouragement. You had very active bike advocacy group that encouraged it. You did have supportive people at City Hall, and I think that made a difference to it, too. At a certain point, I do think it did kind of take off. You know, it's really – I've likened it in many ways to kind of getting the ecology right, and then the flora and fauna will follow. And I'm always struck that when you give cyclists half an ecological niche, they'll start appearing. You know, you see a lot of times, you know, small numbers of cyclists in what seem like the most unforgiving places, but they've figured out a little way to make it work. Let me tell you a funny little story real quick. Several weeks ago, I was in the town of Sammamish, which is on the east side of Seattle, way out in the suburbs. It's the Sammamish Plateau. You know, it's the exurbs, large suburban lots. You have to drive up some steep hills to get to my sister and brother-in-law's house. And my brother-in-law took me out for a bike ride up there. We went about a 16-mile loop, and he managed to keep us off the busy roads, and I didn't realize that it could be as bike friendly as it was. And we went on little trails that had been cut through by, you know, maybe kids and other cyclists and things like that. And you really, in your mind, you started to get an image of, even in place that seems somewhat unforgiving, if you put a little effort into it, you could make an infrastructure that would work for bicycles.
You know, the people in San Francisco say the same thing. Despite their hills, they've managed to make the city very bike-friendly. You write about the sometimes conflicts between bikes and pedestrians. So clearly, if you make a place bike-friendly, it doesn't automatically become pedestrian-friendly. What can you do to accommodate both?
Yeah, I think I challenge a little bit on that. I mean, I do think a lot of what makes a city bikeable can also make it pedestrian friendly, because I think, once again, when you start paying attention to kind of having some density, having a lot of attractive locations and things close by, you know, you nurture districts that provide a range of, for example, a range of retail. You know, one thing that cities are doing much more are allowing mixed use developments. You know, that used to be kind of verboten. Now you never see, for example, a condo go up in Portland without retail on the first level. Same with, you know, office towers, and they try to make much more inviting so that it is more interesting to walk. And an important thing for pedestrians and for cyclists is the whole safety in numbers. And really, it's a virtuous circle. The more cyclists and pedestrians you get out there, the more safe it is going to be for them. And that's an important thing, too. Now, you know, there are other things. Sometimes the two modes can conflict. It gets kind of technical, but, you know, there's, you know, like, for example, putting bulb outs at intersections to make a shorter distance for pedestrians to cross. Depending on how you do it, that potentially can interfere with bike lanes, for example. But generally, you know, if you're slowing down the vehicle traffic in cities, particularly in downtown areas, providing attractive places to walk, that also benefits cyclists as well, I think.
In Copenhagen, Cyclists account for 34% of commute trips. Can any city in the U.S. rival that?
Not at this point. The closest, I think, well, Boulder and Davis, both relatively small college towns, both have very high mode share.
Boulder in Colorado, Davis in
California. Right. Davis is really, and I wrote a chapter really focused on Davis, is really kind of the original bike city in the U.S. You know, it started out, and the thing that really spurred it is that the University of California at Davis, in the, you know, when it was really built out in the 60s, and one of their first chancellors really made the decision that this campus, you know, he was going to ban cars from most of the campus. He happened to be an avid cyclist himself, and to him it just made a lot more sense to get around this area. And as a result, you had a huge, pardon the term, huge critical mass for cyclists. I mean, they were cycling to get around this spread out campus, you know, that had a lot of agricultural research and stuff like that, and bikes were a perfect way to get around. And so the town became very bike friendly. At one time, I think you had a mode share of as high of about 21%. That's dropped in recent years because you have so many people living in Davis now who commute, you know, to Sacramento or other long commutes. You know, it's not so much of a company town anymore. And so there's some other issues like that. Boulder has been increasing its mode share. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think among residents in the city, I think something like 14% are of the trips are by bike. I'm a little bit off on that, but it's a very high, very impressive mode share. Portland, which is the largest among large cities, you know, there's different ways to measure it, but the city auditor does a study every year, and 8% of Portland residents cited the bike as their primary commute vehicle. Now, that's people who live in the city. That doesn't refer, for example, to people who are coming into the city for jobs who, you know, live outside the city. But that's you know, that's very high and much higher than, you know, it was 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, seemingly without much notice, put marked bike lanes all over Manhattan, along with these pedestrian islands that had seating in them. It really did seem as if it happened overnight. Has bike riding significantly increased in New York since he did that?
Yeah, they say that they had a big increase, I want to say around 30% last year in ridership. To be honest, I think it's a little too early to tell. And a lot of cities, you know, we don't have as good a numbers as we'd like to have. There hasn't been as much research into this as there have been in a lot of other areas of transportation. You know, there's just sort of a lot of basic questions that haven't been answered. But the official figures and certainly what people sort of anecdotally are seeing out in the street, it certainly does indicate that there is a big increase in ridership. Once again, I think so much of this kind of flew under the radar screen that people didn't notice it a lot. Another important thing that happened back in New York, really literally it was sort of overshadowed by 9/11. I can't remember if it opened right before or right after 9/11, but the West Side Greenway, which is essentially a multimodal trail, actually there's a separate part for bikes and for pedestrians, runs the entire, yeah, basically virtually the entire western side of Manhattan. You know, you can go from Battery Park all the way up to the northern end of Manhattan with a couple of exceptions and stay on this trail. And that's, I think they call that the busiest bike highway in America. And that's encouraged a lot of people to ride who otherwise would say, well, I don't want to brave the streets of New York. But New York is a fascinating, fascinating example because it's really, in many ways, tailor-made for bicycle travel because of the density. The distances are so short. And I love cycling in Manhattan. I can get places faster really almost in any other way. And once you kind of learn how to ride in the streets of New York, I will admit this is not for everybody. It is a thrill. And it's getting better. You know, they have installed the first, you know, Copenhagen Netherlands-style cycle tracks. They're starting to put those in where you are separated from vehicle traffic. You know, there's the curb, there's the cycle track, there's parking, and then there's the street. I was in New York a couple months ago, and I went down the first one that they've completed on Lower West 9th Avenue. It only runs about 9 blocks, and I just kept circling around doing it again and again because it was so much fun. It was like an e-ticket ride at Disneyland. But someday, I predict, you will be able to ride in a lane like that from Lower Manhattan all the way up to Central Park, and you could take a 9-year-old on that and feel very safe.
Mm-hmm. You know? And Mayor Sam Adams in Portland has announced the first track.
Yeah, for Portland, they've got a couple in the works. But, yeah, the first one looks now like it's going to be this, gosh, 5, 6, 7 block long stretch on Broadway in front of Portland State University. And it's significant because they're taking a lane of vehicle travel away to accomplish that. So that's going to raise some hackles to do that. And, of course, there's a lot of folks who say, well, what good is this little stretch going to do? And, of course, that's the issue. Anytime you're doing a transition like this, you have to start somewhere. I'm sure, for example, you know, you've run into this when people start talk about streetcar or light rail lines, because the first ones, well, gosh, we spent all this money and we get 3 or 4 miles of track.
Yeah, it's the next 3 or 4 miles that count.
Right, you know, and it eventually you build a network and it becomes more useful to use. And, you know, that's just, once again, that's true. You know, I guess the thinking is you have to start somewhere.
Just one more quick question, Jeff. What most stands in the way of getting people on bikes in cities for purposeful trips as opposed to riding for recreation?
I'd say if you had to say the one thing, and I mean, I think there's more than one factor, but I think safety is still a major concern. I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, I think it's a scary thought for a lot of people to be out on the street with motor vehicle traffic. It's something that they're not used to. And, you know, it does take a little bit of training and experience. You know, most people kind of build up to it. A lot of people call the bike and pedestrian trails kind of training wheels for taking to city streets to ride. You know, in my opinion, I think we need to do a lot just generally on traffic safety in this country. I mean, the number of people who are killed and injured in vehicle accidents of all kind in this country is just a travesty. I think somebody was telling me the other day that if we had the same per capita rates as they do in Europe, we'd save something like 20,000 lives every year in America. I mean, that's just a stunning figure.
It is a stunning figure. Jeff, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City. The book is Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Jeff Mapes covers politics for Portland's Oregonian newspaper, and he's the author of the book Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing the World. Governments around the world are working on new regulations to prevent another financial meltdown. In this week's City Views commentary, Walker Smith gives us a little history on the ways government can interact with the marketplace.
I was reading Robert Samuelson's new book the other day, and it dredged up memories of the 1970s that I had completely forgotten. Samuelson is an economic and business columnist for Newsweek and the Washington Post, and his new book is called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath. That kind of gives you the story right there, and that's what I had forgotten. Inflation paralyzed the American economy in the 1970s. It gave rise to a decade of stagflation, a term economists use to characterize a period of high inflation and economic stagnation. This is unusual because inflation occurs most often during periods of growth. Indeed, one of the many ways in which inflation can be triggered is by too much government spending and investment to stimulate growth. Too much money chasing too few goods is the definition of inflation, and usually too much money means strong growth because businesses start springing up to chase those dollars. Not in the 1970s, though. Stagnation, and thus stagflation, was the problem then. Not that the federal government wasn't trying to do everything it could to rein in inflation. In fact, government intervention had been going on since the 1960s. As Samuelson notes in his book, LBJ used every trick he had to stop companies from raising prices and unions from raising wages. If he couldn't simply talk them out of it, he used the powers of the federal government. He sold federal stockpiles of aluminum when aluminum companies raised prices. He did the same thing when copper companies raised prices, along with suspending an import duty and restricting exports. When shoe prices went up, he used export controls to increase leather supplies. When lamb prices rose, he ordered lamb to be purchased from New Zealand for the troops in Vietnam. Not to mention what he did to keep down the prices of color TVs, appliances, paper cartons, newsprint, men's underwear, women's hosiery, glass containers, cellulose, air conditioners, and eggs. In the 1970s, President Nixon moved from LBJ's jawboning to direct wage and price controls. first imposed in August 1971 and intended for just 90 days, these controls were extended through four phases and did not end until 1973. In 1974, President Ford used the threat of an investigation by the Federal Wage and Price Council to force U.S. Steel to roll back announced price increases. And President Carter announced voluntary wage and price controls in 1978, following one of the coldest winters on record, in which nationwide natural gas shortages prompted him to impose a price ceiling on natural gas. The biggest problem during all of this was inflationary expectations. People expected prices to rise, so they took that into account in asking for wage increases and planning future prices. This created a nearly intractable inflationary spiral. And it took the severe monetary policies of then Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker to break the back of inflationary expectations with the severe double-dip recession from 1980 to 1982. No surprise, I guess, that people were ready for President Reagan's promise of less government. I had forgotten how much government used to be involved in the everyday workings of the economy. It's useful to remember this as we react with disgust and outrage over the absolute lack of government regulation, oversight, and involvement that has characterized the past decade during the housing bubble. When we needed government, it simply let us down and dropped us into this economic black hole from which we must now climb out. Mortgage-backed securities are the poster child for why we must have more government involvement in the economy. But wage and price controls are the poster child for why we don't want to solve one problem with another. What we need is a heavy hand with a light touch. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Group. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. If you want to find out more about the work our guests are doing for cities, there's more information at our website, smartcityradio.com. While you're there, you can subscribe to our podcast, read my blog, sign up for our newsletter, or you can also follow me on Twitter at @ccoletta. We love to hear from listeners. That means you. Get in touch by clicking on the contact button or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. No, he will not beam you up. I'm Carol Coletta.